both parties have to care about mutual success. If somebody wants a partner, but they're really looking for a one-way relationship, that becomes obvious really quickly, and it kills partnerships. Nobody, no matter how big or how small, loves just giving. You know, there's got to be that ability for both parties to succeed, and there's got to be care behind it. If there's no care and there's no, I'm going to help you drive your business, then I don't think you have a good partnership. I think you have a relationship, but you don't necessarily have a partnership.
Welcome to The Ultimate Guide to Partnering. In this podcast, Vince Menzione, a proven industry sales and partner executive, brings together technology leaders in this forum to discuss transformational trends and to deconstruct successful strategies to thrive and survive in the rapid age of cloud transformation. And now your host, Vince Menzione.
Welcome to the 25th episode of The Ultimate Guide to Partnering. This podcast episode features Tony DiBenedetto, the chairman, CEO, and co-founder of TriBridge, a DXC company. TriBridge recently won Microsoft's highest honor as the 2017 Dynamics Partner of the Year, and several of my friends in the industry recommended I have Tony on as a guest, and he didn't disappoint. Tony's career is pretty amazing. A few highlights: 30 years of experience in the technology industry, is the recipient of numerous leadership awards, including the Ernst & Young Florida Entrepreneur of the Year Award and induction in the Florida State University College of Business Hall of Fame. And recently, CRN Magazine ranked him among the top 25 technology disruptors in the country. Tony co-founded TriBridge in 1998 and led the company through the successful acquisition and integration of several companies, resulting in a compounded annual growth rate of over 40% each year. Under his guidance, TriBridge has grown from a startup to one of the leading technology companies in the United States. Tony and I had a really great conversation on TriBridge's journey to premier status with Microsoft, some of TriBridge's successful solution areas, where he sees the business moving forward now as part of DXC, his secret sauce in partnering with Microsoft, and his professional journey. And as with each episode, I appreciate your feedback. You can reach me at vincem@cloudwavepartners.net. And if you're listening on iTunes, please rate and review this podcast. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoy this episode. Tony, I want to welcome you to the podcast. I'm so excited to have you here on our podcast. TriBridge has been a premier Microsoft Dynamics partner for quite some time, award-winning partner, and your organization has done some great work. In fact, one of our previous guests, Mike Batt, on episode 4, specifically discussed the success with TriBridge in opening up new markets in the government space. So it's an exciting time for you, given the firm's recent acquisition by DXC and your 2017 award for Partner of the Year. So I'm so excited to have you. Welcome to the podcast.
Vince, it's great to be here, and I appreciate have the time today.
So I want to dive right in and have a lot of questions here to ask about you and the business. So why don't we just start off with, you know, you're the CEO and co-founder of TriBridge. And for our listeners, I thought it would be great if you could take them through the genesis of the business from its founding and what were the early days like, your guiding principles when you started. So could you do that?
Sure. At the time, I was a partner at Arthur Andersen in the business consulting division. And to be honest with you, I just, year after year, had a thirst for starting my own company. I had started a couple companies early in my career at Andersen. And I was at that point where I knew I was going to leave. It was just a question of what. And it first started with having just some meetings at my house where me and a couple of friends would get together and just talk about what businesses we wanted to build. And we came up with crazy ideas, as you might expect. Some were technology and some were like a bar across from the Tampa Bay Bucks Stadium. And that series of getting together with other entrepreneurs led to us forming TriBridge. And in fact, we started, our first business plan was really a mid-market, over-the-web CRM solution. At the time, Salesforce was not out yet. And we went for some funding for that. And that funding fell through. But the advice we got from that entrepreneur who was going to fund us was, why don't you do what you know? Like, why are you not doing something in the tech space around what you guys are good at? And so I wound up building the plan for TriBridge and raising just a little bit of capital based on that advice. And that's how we launched TriBridge back in September of 1998. And interestingly enough, the business morphed over time. You know, we started out really just as a services company, but came back to that quest for being a software company, which was what the first business plan was, and then started building our own software in 2009. And if you look at our company today, we really started several businesses inside of Tribridge's practice areas, but really morphed the business from services only to now a software services and cloud company, all integrated to deliver solutions for customers. And all of that was based on the advice we got in the early May of 1998 when we were raising money for the original Tribridge.
And was Microsoft an early partner in those days?
Yeah, pretty quick into our days as early Tribridge services partner, one of the guys that I started the firm with, Mike Hertigan, he really had a thirst for custom development, and he was building stuff in the Microsoft tool set. So we were a Microsoft partner day one, and what happened was we started becoming more and more known within the Microsoft world, and we started meeting with them at higher levels, and they started asking us about Dynamics, because at the time, we were not a Dynamics partner. And it took probably 5 years or more before we went over to the Dynamics side of the business, which was late 2003, early 2004. But that's because we started out just doing application development in Microsoft tools. So we technically have been a partner the whole time. We've been a Dynamics partner since August of 2003.
And what were some of those early customers and work that you did?
I remember we did a early portal for Outback Steakhouse. We did a big project for Marriott Vacation Club, as an example. Marine Max, which is a public company in Florida that's a boat retailer. We did a series of projects for them in the early days. So even though we were a pretty small company, we were landing some brands that were way bigger than we were because of some personal relationships. And then, you know, once you do good work for somebody, that helps you not only do more work for them, but also get you recognized within their industry as being somebody that can help. And so that led to us getting certainly a lot more projects.
And so you said, I think 2009, you developed this Dynamics practice and started building business applications or solutions on the Dynamics platform. Can you talk to our listeners a little bit about that? Was there a specific customer that Microsoft brought to you, or was there an opportunity? How did that evolve?
Well, we actually developed our Dynamics practice back in 2004, but in terms of us building our own software, that was 2009. And the first solution we developed was really through partnering with Microsoft. They had a client in the state and local government space that needed a more modern jail and offender management system because they were having problems with their mainframe systems, and prisoners were being let go at the wrong time, and they weren't tracking prisoners very well from the state, down from the county up to the state. And so Microsoft was looking for a partner, and we had such a good relationship and performed so well, especially in the CRM category, that we built an application for a large Midwestern state to redo all of their offender management system. So the intake of a prisoner through the release and all the processes in the middle. And as a result of the work, because the particular customer wanted a pretty significant discount on the work, as well as they wanted us to perpetuate the IP, we formally kept the IP with agreement from the customer. And then really from that point forward, we launched our offender management solution in 2009. And since then, that's been a huge part of our growth story, not only with Microsoft, but just with the broader Justice and Public Safety group. And we've built other applications like probation management, pretrial management, and other parts of the Justice and Public Safety system because of the success we had with those early large state prison systems and mid-size county prison systems. But yes, it all started with that one customer.
And then you mentioned businesses within Tribridge. Can you talk to our listeners a little bit about that? I know you have other practices. You know, you talked about offender management and some of those state and local solutions. I know, for instance, that you have healthcare as an area of focus for the company, and you've been awarded Microsoft Partner Awards for that as well. Maybe you can talk about that.
you know, we noticed that we're doing a lot of work in healthcare, and with our early success with our offender management solution, we wanted to build something that was more leading edge around preventative healthcare and population health. We noticed there was a shift going on, partly with the Affordable Care Act, but partly with chief medical officers wanting to try to involve the patient more on the front end of healthcare and not wait till you had some type of acute disease. And so we built at first a care coordination module, but really led to our Health 360 solution, which today is in some of the largest hospitals in the country. And it really was our thinking that we could make a difference in the way people live their lives. And many of us were frustrated with the healthcare system in general. And so this gave us an opportunity to not only do something good for business, but also feed our mission. And the mission of the company from the first day was to improve the lives of other people by serving them. And since that was the mission of why we do things, that solution particularly was easy to take off the ground and launch. And instead of having a customer there, we actually did that one on spec and then built a pipeline and a market opportunity around it. We were a little ahead of the curve in the beginning, but now it looks like if you read anything, we're recognized widely, not just by Microsoft, of being a leader in population health with our Health 360 solution. And a year ago became a global ISV for Microsoft. And then obviously with the recent acquisition by DXC, we hope to promote this product on a global basis so that we can help other countries with their healthcare as well.
And you also have your own cloud services company, Concerto. Maybe you can share some of that story with our listeners as well.
Yep, that's another element of the business. So, you know, we're talking a lot about the software side, and obviously Concerto is more on the cloud side of the business. Similar entrepreneurial moment for us. We had one of our leaders going to a couple of the Microsoft conferences early when BPOS was coming out. And, you know, we were talking with a lot of our customers about, you know, we were going to have a BPOS practice, which eventually led to Azure. And the feedback we got in those early days was they were uncomfortable putting mission critical applications in a public cloud. And so we pretty quickly recognized around 2008 that it was important for us to build an infrastructure in a private cloud, a virtual private cloud, which eventually led to our now today hybrid cloud. But in those days, we built it because we had so many customers doing mission critical stuff with us, you know, formula management systems, financial systems, sales management systems, cancer. We had a customer that was trying to cure cancer by looking at, you know, the DNA of people that were getting sick. And that's not the kind of stuff you want to have sitting in a public cloud at the time. And so we built this thing to be at just a different level of security. Yes, we have some shared elements of it, but the ability for the client to customize security, have their application layer just be theirs, have their database layer just be theirs, have their virtualization layer just be theirs. And that gave us a lot more control over uptime as well as security. And it just gave us an offering that was a premium offering. And so that has led to a very successful business called Concerto. Today, we are deeply, deeply partnered with Microsoft on the Azure side. So we have many customers that will come to us for all their cloud needs and say, hey, you know, we want to run our very confidential stuff in a private cloud, but we have a lot of stuff that we want to run in a public cloud to take advantage of that pricing. And so we can manage all of that because we have built not only a hybrid cloud, but we've built a set of tools that allow you to manage across public and private cloud in kind of that one pane of glass so that you can manage across all those different instances, but also get the benefits of the different types of clouds that are available. So that's a very different business for us, but it was that entrepreneurial spirit early and then partnering with Microsoft along the way. In fact, Microsoft helped fund our first hybrid cloud and helped us build out the connection to Azure real early in the process. And that's the kind of partnership we've had with them. And I think that's why we continue to do well in that Microsoft space.
So what do you think makes your value proposition unique to customers and then also to Microsoft? Can you take our listeners through that?
Yeah, you know, I think the thing that our customers see in us are probably two important things. One, our business model for a long time now has been one integrated answer around cloud software and services. And, you know, it's weird. I've worked in the technology space for now 30 something years, almost 34 years. And for a long time, it was an industry that was supposed to be leading edge, yet to get a complete solution, oftentimes you had to go to multiple parties, which is strange. You know, when you buy a car, you don't buy the wheels from somebody, the engine from someone else, then hire a completely different firm to integrate it.
Right. Right.
We relied on that. Yet mission critical systems are in large part bought and sold that way and implemented that way. And that bugged me for years. And so our business model says, look, you can have one firm that takes responsibility for the software that you're purchasing and that you need for your business, the infrastructure it sits on. Hopefully our Concerto Cloud, but it could be in Azure or it could be on-premise. And then the service is to integrate it all. That's one company. And being able to do that for our customers gives us a competitive edge from a quality perspective. There's no finger pointing. You really own the whole thing as a provider, which really shortens the cycle. I've been involved in engagements in other organizations where that wasn't the case, and you wind up fighting with the third parties. The customer's just not happy. We avoid all that, you know, and so I think that's one critical element of our competitive edge. But the other one is that we have been very focused on some micro vertical industries, and that's allowed us to focus on some problems that we've solved hundreds of times. You start getting to a point where you solve a problem hundreds of times for large corporations, you get really good at it. And so not only do we have solutions that do it, but we have the people that have been around that specific micro vertical, and we know how to solve the problem. We know how to speak the language. And, you know, most of these business problems are extremely complex. That's why we get called in. If they were easy, customers would just fix them. But they're complex. They're not as easy as they look on the surface. And the experience of doing these things many, many, many times just gives us an edge. And I think a lot of, you know, 85% of the revenue at TriBridge is in industries and micro verticals that we've done over and over again. Only 15% of our revenue comes from stuff that is less repeatable to us. And again, that just builds a lot of assets in a company like ours, whether it's the people, the skill set, it could be intellectual property, it could be software. Even our cloud has become industry focused. So we've fine-tuned our cloud with an industry micro vertical bent to it. And you could see how the customers respond well to that, not only in the sales cycle, but also as we're working with them, they get the sense, wow, you guys clearly have done this over and over again.
So with the recent acquisition by DXC, where do you see the company headed? You talked about the verticals and micro verticals you're in now. Is there anticipation of moving into other markets for growth? How do you see growth?
Yeah. So the cool thing about the acquisition for us is that DXC is obviously a very large global company, and we were just starting the planning to expand our solutions globally. So our ability to now to take our industry solutions on a global stage, it was part of why we did the acquisition. I think it's part of why DXC did the acquisition as well. The second thing is just our partnership with Microsoft. You know, we had a very strong partnership with Microsoft, but again, having the size organization that we have now, we clearly, with the combined organization, are the largest Microsoft Dynamics company in the world. And so now our partnership with Microsoft is even more important, not only to us, but to Microsoft. So I think that is the second kind of place of growth. The third one is, you know, we're picking up some other micro vertical solutions with DXC. And so where maybe we had customers before that we either turned the work down or we were doing it in that 15% of the revenue, now we have experts across the globe in retail and other parts of the business that are in addition to the micro verticals we had. So it expands our solution offering in terms of more industries we can go after. It gives us global reach. Gives us a better partnership with Microsoft in terms of growth. And then finally, gives us a platform for our hybrid cloud. There's over 6,000 customers of TriBridge and DXC for us to expose these solutions to. And we're excited about that opportunity because they're customers of the broader company.
Yeah, it's exciting. And, you know, there's so much exciting change going on right now. I'm sure you see it. I call it the rapid age of digital transformation. But what are you seeing customers more willing to do today than they were, let's say, just 3 years ago?
I think customers, for one, they're on their third or fourth rodeo. Like it used to be when I first started in this business, most of the customers were doing their first ERP application. They were doing their first CRM application. And there's a little bit of a black box theory back then, you know, oh, just let the consultant figure it out or just let the tech firm figure it out. Well, that's changed. So today, the thing I've noticed about customers is, yes, the demand's higher in terms of, you know, what the expectations are, but their level of partnering and contributing to the project is at an all-time high. And so I'm excited about the way customers view technology as a strategic weapon, not just as infrastructure. And so we run into lots of customers today. I mean, it's almost the norm now that they want to build some technology, use some technology, and do it in a unique way, typically to change the business model. You know, there's a lot of pressure going on now with the global competitiveness to subscription billing and subscription business models and new business models and disrupt supply chains. And all of those things are changing the way traditional companies that have been doing business for hundreds of years or 100 years in some cases. And so I think their willingness to do the kind of innovative stuff that we've been doing is really exciting. And then the other part I would say is the comfort level with the cloud has changed dramatically in 3 years, just night and day from where it was. So the ability for customers in pretty much every industry now to take advantage of ubiquitous infrastructure, a cloud infrastructure, a hybrid cloud infrastructure, is just much more prevalent today. And I think it's the early days of cloud in the big scheme of things. So I think the creativeness and the innovation that's going to come out of, you know, more customer demand and more willingness to try things, I think we're going to see just another set of kind of evolution of what's possible in the cloud that we haven't seen before, whether that's development, whether that's outsourcing, whether that's a different way to consume infrastructure and applications. But you're seeing creativity happening with all kinds of companies because of the willingness to use the cloud. I mean, if you think about Uber, the fact that they took on probably more than 100-year-old business in the taxi business and just revolutionized it with kind of a new business model is just one small example of what you're seeing our customers doing every day.
Do you have any specific examples? I know you're talking about public cloud. I think quite a bit about Uber. I think about data state, I guess is the term I'm looking for here, where that information is just so meaningful to disrupting a particular market like Uber did with transportation, with taxi service, and you're seeing with Airbnb and others. Are there any specific examples you might have for our listeners?
Yeah, we've got two solutions that I think are changing models. One of it is the way we consume healthcare. If you think about, at least, you know, I'm in my mid-50s and have all kinds of those health issues you start to care about. But most of my interactions with doctors is reactive. You know, I go to the doctor every 6 months or whatever, and they check my blood, and they're kind of waiting for me to have something wrong, you know, and then they'll treat it. And that's the way I've been doing it really for most of my life. And with our Health 360 product and with some of the leading hospitals across the globe and the way they're using our solution, I mean, they're interacting with their customer and the patient every day, and they're building a care plan. So instead of waiting for a heart attack, they're preventing heart attacks. Instead of waiting to come to the hospital, they're building smaller hospitals because they're caring for their patients through technology. And there's lots of ways that they do that with us, especially with the Internet of Things. So for instance, let's just pretend I had cardiac disease in my family and I was a patient of one of our customers that used Health 360. I'd have a care plan because I'm in a identified group that could have this issue. And so they tell me I have to keep my blood pressure at a certain level, take certain pills, do certain exercises and all that. In the old days, you'd have to lie to your doctor and say you did all those things. And then you get on the scale and he's like, man, it's been 6 months, you gained 5 pounds or whatever. Today, we integrate your scale at home. into the system so that the caregiver knows exactly what you weigh every time you get on the scale. We take your pill box that has a little RF device, and every time you open the pill box and take the pills out, we record that. We know exactly what you're doing on the treadmill. We have your Fitbit connected. We have your Apple Watch connected. You know, we are collecting data at a pace that's never been done before, which is changing the way the information that the drugstore has, the pharmacist has, the doctor, the nurse practitioner, and so they can proactively give you care. But we're not even relying on that. The system then is showing the data and trending the data to give the caregiver information. In some cases, just telling the patient, look, you're doing a great job. You know, your weight and your blood pressure look great. Keep it up. In some cases, they're saying, you know, we saw an elevation in your blood pressure the last time you took it. We really want you to pay attention to your salt or whatever else it is. And so this interaction, this abundance of data, this ability to consume all these interactions makes the caregiving that much better. So we're not just changing the systems, we're actually changing the way the doctor is interacting with the patient because of this ongoing dialogue going over in technology. So I think we're seeing that in a big way with that specific example.
That's a great example. And healthcare has been such an important aspect of the business for Microsoft and in terms of industry. And just that the type of impact to outcomes on people's health is just so meaningful. We talked about new markets. I just want to peel back a little bit further. Is there a market you're not in now or an application space that you think might be intriguing to TriBridge that you'd like to enter into at some point with the new DXC acquisition?
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt our cloud business and both Health360 and our offender management solutions, they've mostly been US-based. And so we have been trying in the last year with our global ISV status to penetrate Europe and Asia and those markets. And so with the now relationship with DXC, absolutely we'll be leveraging the sales teams on a global basis, the customers that they have on a global basis to introduce them to these solutions we're talking about. So there's no doubt about that. And then on the cloud side, it's really the same thing. We have a few European clients. For the most part, we've been US-based. We do have data center capability across 160 countries with the relationship that we have with our data center partner. So our ability to service those customers are there. We just haven't had the brand or the sales team to be able to get those cloud customers as well. So those are the two areas that I think would grow into from a new markets perspective. In terms of the application side of the business, I would say that with the combined business of TriBridge and DXC, I'd say the answer is no, because obviously we're in a bigger business today than we've ever been. I think DXC is, if you look at the public information, roughly $27 billion in revenue. So I think there's other parts of a company's business that we can help because of now a broader capability within DXC. So I think for TriBridge, it's the broader markets and the bigger resources that is really the big change in the next couple of years.
So TriBridge has consistently been a top partner of the year with Microsoft, both in the public sector as well as broadly. In fact, this past year was a worldwide Partner of the Year award. So what do you think makes that, or what makes a great partner? What do you think is the secret sauce that makes a great partner?
Well, I think there's some characteristics of a great partner. I think it starts with a couple of things I always do on the front end of a discussion with a potential partner. One is there has to be some level of shared vision or even shared values. So if you go meet with somebody and they don't want to go to the same places you want to go with the business, it's kind of hard to partner, you know? Or you could just have shared values. Like, we'll run into people all the time and it's clear they're certainly interested economically, but when we start talking about our mission or how we're improving the lives of others, if you think about our healthcare business, if you think about our JPS or our offender management solution, we believe we're making an impact to the world with those solutions. And so that can bond us with a potential partner, Microsoft or anybody else. And so I do think that shared vision or shared values is kind of checkbox one. Checkbox two is both parties have to care about mutual success. If somebody wants a partner, but they're really looking for a one-way relationship, that becomes obvious really quickly and it kills partnerships.
Yep.
Nobody, no matter how big or how small, loves just giving. You know, there's got to be that ability for both parties to succeed, and it's got to be, there's got to be care behind it. If there's no care and there's no, I'm going to help you drive your business, then I don't think you have a good partnership. I think you have a relationship, but you don't necessarily have a partnership. And then the third area that I think just makes a great partner is working hard at the relationship and the communication part. So I would say that's bullet number three. And that starts with, you know, clear expectations, because anything can kill a partnership. It's missed expectations. But then the other thing is just being open. You know, really being open with the dialogue. Hey, well, you're doing well, and this is how you're doing well. Or, hey, it's not working, and here's why. And doing that in an honest and open way, not in a complaining way. One of the pieces of feedback we have gotten for many years is that you guys have been a good partner because, yes, you have challenges with us at Microsoft, but the way you go about it, you know, we don't scream and yell. We don't jump up and down and throw a tantrum. We really engage in dialogue, and sometimes it's frustrating, and sometimes we don't get it resolved as quickly as we want. But I have found it's been much better to be constructive, be clear. That doesn't mean I smile all the time, but be constructive, give the feedback, hold people accountable, but do it in a professional and friendly way, I think does work. I think that is part of that point three of just having that solid relationship. So I think if you can do those three, I think you can be a great partner, but it is a two-way street. Don't expect it all to be that what's Microsoft going to do for you. It's got to be what you can do for Microsoft as well, yeah, or whoever the partner is.
I call that interdependence from the Stephen Covey book, The Seven Habits of Highly Effective People.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
No, that's great. In fact, as you were speaking, I was thinking back on one of my slides. You hit the nail on some of the other conversations I've had about what makes great partnerships. So really great synopsis there, Tony. So talk to me about other partnerships and alliances you might have. Does TriBridge have any other alliances or partnerships outside of the one with Microsoft?
We absolutely have built many alliances outside of the Microsoft world. Many years ago, we hired a person full-time to lead our alliance part of the business and not even manage the Microsoft part, really to reach out to other companies that were selling to our customers, other trusted advisors, whether that was large banks, SunTrust Bank is a good example, or whether it's other consulting firms or accounting firms like Grant Thornton, or whether that's payroll companies or other tech companies like ADP, or whether it's folks that do turnarounds and stuff like that, like Alvarez and Marcel. And so we built these relationships, and we meet with these companies around the globe now, but certainly in the U.S., and we really get together to figure out what's the best way we can help each other's customers. And those alliances have led to probably 25 or 30% of our growth over the years. So you're getting brought in by a trusted advisor of Ernst & Young or Grant Thornton or Dell even. And so because you're being bought in by somebody who's already has a working relationship, we have found that A, you close business faster, and B, you can get to the decision makers quickly. And we do the same thing for those firms. So we set that up years ago, and it's really that idea of being an alliance partner with somebody and being able to help them grow their business has worked for us even outside of the technology ecosystem.
So with those partners, have you ever seen situations where the partner you were working with just wasn't getting it working with TriBridge? And what would you say to them now, if you could, to get them on the path to success?
Well, that's a good question. I haven't seen that a lot with the alliances. I've certainly talked to other Microsoft partners about things that have not been working for them. And so we've talked through what things we can do better or not do better. I think one thing I would say is when you're in a relationship that's not working is you almost have to take stock. Am I being a giver? You know, am I giving? And I find this with the Microsoft partners in particular. They're like, yeah, we're not getting any leads from Microsoft. They're a terrible partner. And I'm like, well, what have you done? Like, what are you bringing to the table? Are you bringing a solution? Are you bringing customers? Are you bringing new market opportunities that they haven't thought about? that's the advice I typically give them is like, and that, you know, there's sometimes fear to do that with a partner like Microsoft. Oh, they may give it to someone else. But I found it like, once you can go sit down with an executive at Microsoft or any company and start talking about how to grow their business, it really changes the dynamic. And then I think the second part of the thing I typically see is people that are hoarding information. And so I think to be a good partner and to turn around that dynamic that's not working, it's that willingness to be involved and share your knowledge. I think that also will turn around a negative situation. So those are the two things, the piece of advice I've given to other Microsoft partners. In terms of our alliance partners, I can't think of an example specifically where it didn't work. I think if it didn't, like in an engagement with a customer, the biggest thing is communication, right? It's
right.
It isn't working, the customer's not happy, here's what we need to do. We've certainly had people that have dropped out of our alliances before, but I would say when that has happened, it's really been about people just want to take. So I'll go back to my giver thing. There's a great book called The Go-Giver that really talks about how to give to a relationship first. And we give that book to everybody that joins our alliances team so that they understand what the expectations are. This is about giving, not with a complete expectation of getting, because it doesn't work that way. You may get in the big scheme of things, but maybe not from that partner specifically. And so I think that's another way to solve the problem is to start with giving.
Start with giving. And in fact, you know, I had a conversation just recently with Amir Capriles, who's a friend of both of ours, who we discussed your partnership with Microsoft and that journey. He mentioned that mutual skin in the game. And maybe that's a little bit of that, maybe from what I'm hearing from this conversation.
Yeah, I think so. Amir and I have done a lot of deals together, and the ones that go great, we celebrate great, but you know, you get one or two that doesn't work great. And I would tell you, Amir is a great example of a good partner, a great partner. And we had an account, a pretty large account, that wasn't going well. And we couldn't get the customer to engage the way we wanted. The customer was frustrated as well. And he came up with an idea that was risky, would put us at some brand risk and financial risk, but we thought it was the best outcome. And we did it, and it was messy, and we did it together, and we got through it, and it landed. But it took many months of trust. It took a financial commitment by both of us to right the problem. It would have been easy to walk away for either of us, blame the other. And, you know, they were heated moments for sure. But I think both of us came out of that, it's probably 8 or 9 years ago, and just got closer, right? Through that tough situation where both of us had to really invest a lot of capital, intellectual, financial, resource capital. We left it at a much stronger relationship and trust going down the road. And you know, again, 90-something% of our interactions have been phenomenal. But when we had tough times, you really learn about people, you know? And one thing I learned about Amir is he is honorable and can make the tough calls. And I think he learned the same thing about me. And it's allowed us to be stronger partners going forward. So absolutely, you know, that was about giving, and that was also about honoring the partnership. So I think Amir has just been great from that perspective.
Well, one of the attributes I've had people say is that the person will say the same thing about the partner, whether they're in the room or not. And Amir said pretty much the same thing about you in our conversation. So there. So it is a mutual partnership for sure.
Oh, that's great.
So any other advice you have for our partner listeners on partnering specifically?
Now, the last thing I'd say is I think Microsoft's great at helping you develop new business ideas. I'd bring them into the fold with strategic planning. I have found there's definitely executives over there that will help you grow your business. So that's another way to extend the partnership as you're thinking about 2018 planning. Bring them into the mix. And it doesn't have to just be about Microsoft. I think there's a lot of smart people that can help you broadly.
That's great advice. And Tony, as you might know from listening to other episodes, I'm fascinated with how people got to this particular spot in life. And so I wanted to focus a portion of our time here on the personal and professional journey, because I believe it helps others that are aspiring to maybe being the founder or CEO of a company or a leader in the technology space. So I was hoping maybe you could share with our listeners some of your journey How did you get started, and talk our listeners through that?
Sure. No, absolutely. You know, I've definitely been asked before, like, did you know you were an entrepreneur? When did you know that? You know, that question gets asked a lot. And I got to tell you, when I was growing up, and I had kind of a rough childhood, I lived in, from 7th grade to 12th grade, I lived in about 15 different homes. So I had definitely a lot of different people around me from really all walks of life. I lived in a very, very tough neighborhoods. It wasn't all good business advice. But I never knew what the word entrepreneur meant. I never heard that word before. So the funny thing is, for years, I never knew what that word was, even though I believe in looking backwards, I had a lot of those characteristics, you know, risk-taking and, you know, wanting to lead and wanting to serve people and those things. But one particular thing that has stuck out to me, there's a guy in college, a friend of mine, this guy, Larry Stegall, and Larry, I always thought he was a little bit crazy, you know, and I hope he's listening. And so Larry kept telling me he's developing this business. And we were going to school in Tallahassee, Florida, which is not the most advanced tech community in the world.
So Florida, State, yep.
Florida State University, right. And this is in 1983, so a long time ago. And Larry has me helping him. So I was working for him, I guess. You know, he's a friend. He needed help. And the business model was he was importing Brazilian art duty-free and selling it in Tallahassee, Florida at the flea market. And what I didn't realize at the time, I thought I was just helping my friend. I was making some money. But what I was watching was an entrepreneur. And Larry went on to other businesses as he graduated and been a lifelong entrepreneur. He's owned land. He's owned an electronics distributor. He's learned a lychee farm. I mean, he's just been all over the map, and he's done well. But those early days at FSU, just watching him import goods and learn that process and take the risk of people in Tallahassee wanting imported Brazilian art, I mean, that seems like a crazy idea. Yet he did very well. So that had a big impact on me wanting to do my own thing. And I think, believe it or not, so did the New York Yankees. I think, you know, George Steinbrenner owned the Yankees. He bought the Yankees in 73, and he bought them for like $7 million. And I remember thinking, oh, I want to be like George Steinbrenner. I want to own the Yankees. So I need to own my own business too, because he owned his own businesses. And so there was this, because I was a huge baseball fan, huge Yankee fan. So there's this Larry on one hand, this very practical example of a guy right in front of me. And again, I didn't know what the word meant. And then I had George Steinbrenner kind of as my, you know, I'll call him far away role model, that was buying businesses and bought the Yankees. And I was just like, yeah, that's what I want to do. And so that motivated me to do my own thing. Even though I worked at a big firm, it really motivated me to do something that I could control, both the quality and the speed. And then, you know, I do think I have a strange motor. I mean, I like to grow. I like to push. I like the pace. And so, you know, I figured out early on that everybody didn't really have that. And so taking advantage of that pace in a way that allowed me to be part of stuff that grows. That's part of the early kind of just maturing and trying to understand who you are, and then saying, what do you do with this? Like, what do you do with this pace and this ambition? And I decided to go the entrepreneurial route, again, not even knowing what that word meant.
So a huge Yankee fan.
Yeah, I'm a diehard Yankee fan.
So have you ever thought about owning a franchise? Is that an aspiration in your future?
It is. I would say the price of franchises has gone up so many mega folds. So my revised thought process is either minor leagues or a very, very small sliver of a large major league team. But yeah, I still have the desire to be part of building a world-class sports franchise. I just may have to go about it differently based on the economics of the game. I think the Marlins were just sold for $1.3 billion. So
yeah.
Just the economics have changed so much.
So let's, you know, you talked about this kind of, I think you called it a weird motor or a different motor. What are some of the most fun aspects of the job for you then?
I think, you know, you like to win, and that's another attraction I have for the Yankees. They're just hooked on winning. So it's fun to be successful and to win and to grow a business. That has turned me on for a long time. We've had 18 straight years of growth here at Tribridge, and you get addicted to it. It's exciting. I think the second thing that sticks out for me is just watching other people grow. We had a lot of people run through here, and some have started their own companies. I think we've had about 25 people leave and start their own company. And it's been exciting to watch people grow from, in some cases, real young in their careers to, you know, leading parts of TriBridge, or, you know, somebody that came, you know, from a different company with an experience that was different and maybe down and stuff. And then they come here and get lit up. And so I didn't expect to like that. But over the years, you know, you start looking at, you know, thousands of people that you've worked with, and you watch them grow, and light bulbs go off and careers start, you get excited about it. And, you know, you get to see even the personal growth. You see them get married or have kids or have grandkids now. There's something that I didn't expect to really get connected to emotionally, but it really has touched me in a way that I didn't expect. And it, you start caring at a different level about them. So
these people that go off on their own, was there a best piece of career advice that you received when you started out that maybe you've imparted to others when they've left to start their own journey?
I mean, I've had a lot of mentors, so I've been pretty fortunate. One guy that stands out that continues to give me great advice is Tom Wallace. He's a local entrepreneur, a serial entrepreneur, very successful. He, early on, and this is so basic, but it really has played out. Like, we were pitching him a business plan for the software company that wasn't TriBridge. And he turned us down. He said, no, I'm not going to fund that. I don't like the space. Didn't understand the space. But what he said was, do what you know, right? He was the guy that gave us that advice. But more importantly, he's like, listen to the customer. He goes, Tony, whatever you start, the business is going to morph. And really pay attention to the markets and the customer, and then start planning ahead, you know? And after that moment in May of 1998, we took that to heart. And every year forever, as we started our planning, we really took a wide view of stakeholders and said, we're going to listen to customers, and we're going to listen to our partners, and we're going to listen to our team members. And instead of us thinking we knew all the answers, we'd start with a straw man, and then we'd go around to 15 or 20 customers, show them the plan, and then make changes. And several of our ideas, in fact, our infrastructure practice initially came from a customer who said, hey, this is what I think you should be doing. So I think Tom, again, as simple as it was really all about, you know, paying attention to the market dynamics, listening to customers, and making sure you really understand what the needs are so that you can be ready when they need it. And that was that's something I tell people all the time. And no matter how smart you are, you're never going to be smarter than the market. The market usually is this big inertia. And so you've got to tap into it. The best way to tap into it is to talk to a lot of people. Obviously, you can do research. There's tons of research out there. I love the human element of it. I think the research combined with talking to specific people in specific industries really just rounds out where you should take a business. And I've used that technique every year.
That's some great advice. You mentioned having overcoming some challenges earlier in your life. What about hurdles you've had to face and had to overcome? Can you talk to our listeners about any one in particular, maybe, that stands out for you?
On the business side, you know, nothing big stands out. I'd say, you know, maybe the availability of talent has been a consistent hurdle for the last 18 years, like folks in our industry that can be good culture fits, but also have the technology capabilities. So one of the ways we overcame it, we kept hiring experienced hires. And after about 10 years of that, we decided, yes, we'll keep doing that, but we'd augment it with an on-campus hiring and build our own. And that has paid dividends. Probably almost 20% of our team today have come from our campus hiring. And there's no way we'd be at this point in our development without that.
And what schools do you recruit from?
We recruit all over the country, but in Florida, we recruit at Florida, Florida State, and USF. But we recruit at Wake Forest, campuses in Texas, I think maybe a couple California ones, but it's all over the country.
Nice. And what pursuits or obsessions do you explore when you're not working?
Oh, man, I love baseball. That's probably clear. Yep. I love to hike. So I've done quite a bit of hiking over the years. I travel a lot in my job, so I like to hike particularly mountains. I'm not a climber. I'm not a mountain climber, but I love to hike to the top of any mountain that I can get to. And, you know, so I try to do that a lot. And I love basketball. Those are probably the three things that I love the most. I guess cooking may be the fourth. I probably left that out.
Cooking. What type of food do you like to cook? Are you going to tell me Italian?
Well, I'm Sicilian, but no, I'm kind of across the board. I'm at the house. I'm the one that, like, I'll create recipes or research recipes or watch one of those cooking shows and steal a recipe, and then I'll start messing with it. And it might take me 2 years before I go, okay, now I've got it where I like it. You know what I mean? So yep. I'm not one that will follow the recipe to the T. I had a pizza dough recipe going for about 5 years to the point where I was just kept tweaking it and made probably thousands of pizzas. And today I feel like I finally got something that I can, you know, have people over.
Thin crust or thick crust?
I like thin better, but I do a Sicilian pie every once in a while. That's okay. But I do super thin. Like that's probably partly to keep the size of the carbs down, but I definitely do a thin crust.
Nice. We have to try your pizza one of these days. So who is one of your role models, either directly or indirectly, and what advice or attributes did you learn from them?
Tom Wallace, for sure, big role model. The one thing about Tom that I picked up over the years is accountability. Not just, I always felt like I was personally accountable. What I noticed about Tom and different boards I was on, or he was on our board for a while, is the way he held people accountable. I probably was uncomfortable doing that in my early career, and that can hurt you, you know, as a leader, because people aren't getting stuff done and therefore you're not getting stuff done. And so being able to do that in a way that's professional, I feel like I got that from Tom. That would be one. The second person is George Gordon, another local entrepreneur up in Philadelphia, but moved down here south a few years back. You know, the thing I learned about George was the poise of a leader. You know, I would say I didn't grow up being very poised or tactful or any of those things. And I think George, I watched him. I was in an organization with him where he was the chair and I was the vice chair for about 10 years. And just watching George handle egos and, you know, big board. We had a 30, 40 person board with all the big companies in Tampa on the board, you know, pretty high level people on those boards, CEOs, CFOs, CIOs. And just watching George handle people in a way with poise and grace and professionalism, I was just blown away by the way he could do it. I'm not half of what he can do, but it shaped the way I communicate with folks. And I used to think being direct was the only way to do it. I'm still direct, but I'm certainly doing it differently at 52 than I was at kind of 22.
Nice. What advice would you give that younger self, that 25 to 30 year old Tony DiBenedetto?
Oh, let's see. Younger Tony. I think the concept of being fearless that you probably lose over time a little bit. Man, when I was 20, I thought I was going to buy the Yankees. I left that out, but. You know, and then reality sets in. I think there's something healthy about staying fearless, especially as an entrepreneur, especially as a CEO. You don't want to lose that. So I think continue to be fearless. I'd probably have that mantra and have me chanting it at night. I feel like I'm still pretty fearless, but I am not as fearless as I once was. So I think that's one that stands out.
Nice. Is there one book you've read or gifted often that you recommend to our listeners?
You know, the book I think that's top, one of the top leadership books in the world that I don't think is on everybody's list is called The Servant by James Hunter. And it's a little bit of a different kind of book, and it's all about servant leadership. And I just think the book's an easy read. I give it to folks at Tribridge all the time. And I think it gives you a sense of how you can relate to people and help them get the most out of what they can be. And it focuses on something people don't like to talk about in business. It's about how do you love somebody and truly love them. And that could mean firing them too. So it's not, you know, all about doing something that's nice. It's about truly loving them by helping them get to where they need to go. And that's something that I feel like I've really adopted as part of my style here at TriBridge.
Nice. So The Servant by James Hunter. And
yeah.
We'll have the link to that in our show notes, as well as how, if our listeners want to reach out to you, Tony, what's the best way to do that?
You know, email is probably the best way to do that. TonyD@TriBridge.com. So TonyD@TriBridge.com.
Great. And there any social handles? Do you follow any social media?
Yeah, I have a Twitter. It's Tony TriBridge is my Twitter account. And then on LinkedIn is the other place. And it's Tony DiBenedetto.
Tony, I want to thank you so much. I was so looking forward to this conversation. You've been a great partner of Microsoft for just so many years. Accolades, people that know and respect you within the channel. And I appreciate you taking time to impart on our listeners some of your career nuggets, what makes successful partnerships, and your personal and professional journey with us. And go Yankees.
Vince, it's great talking to you and look forward to hearing it live.
The Ultimate Guide to Partnering with your host, Vince Menzione, will be right back.
Hello there, loyal listeners. Would you enjoy receiving a newsletter from me where I'll provide highlights from our show episodes, useful bits of information around partnering and technology, and thoughts to boost your Thursdays? You can do so by going to my website, cloudwavepartners.net, and signing up for my newsletter. Thank you for listening, and thank you for joining The Ultimate Guide to Partnering.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of The Ultimate Guide to Partnering with your host, Vince Menzione, online at ultimateguidetopartnering.com and facebook.com/ultimateguidetopartnering. We'll catch you next time on The Ultimate Guide to Partnering.